Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Before I introduce our speaker today, it's our tradition at GBF to go around and say our names. Since there's a lot of us today, it would be nice if we could take a second or two to sort of absorb the name before we announce our own names, so we begin to know who we are. I'm Joe Good.
Paul.
Matt.
Tom.
Mark Tilly.
Peter.
Patrick.
Mike.
Rich.
Dwayne.
I'm Howard Deport.
I'm Philip.
Jim Pearson.
David Lewis.
I'm Tony Prospa.
I'm Rob Johnson.
Isabel Walden.
Larry Wisher.
Tom.
Jim.
They are.
Peter.
Andreas.
My name is Heather.
Rick.
Paul Shepherd.
Jack Buffy.
My name is Harley Shapiro.
Mark.
Joe Weston.
Dennis.
George.
Clark.
Gary.
Gary.
Michael.
Lenny.
John Wessel.
Donald Rothberg.
How many of us are new, first or second time visitors? Just raise your hand so we can see you. So old timers, make sure you welcome those people in the social time. Our speaker today is Donald Rothberg. He is on the Teachers Council at Spirit Rock, is active with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and is just completing a two-year training entitled Path to Engagement.
Path to Engagement, yeah.
Did I get that right?
Of Engagement.
Of Engagement.
Yeah.
Which I hope you'll tell us more about.
Okay.
Welcome, Don.
Thank you. We go till about noon?
We're going to talk about 10 up.
10 up, okay. Very good. So it is a pleasure to be here again. I seem to come about once or twice a year, and I was just reminded of the connection between GPF and Buddhist Peace Fellowship, because in some ways GBF started out of a summer institute that we did, I believe, in 1991, and we had an organization for a whole 6 or 7 day summer institute, which left the bulk of the day unorganized, or rather we would say we made it possible to self-organize, and so we weren't offering, as it were, particular sessions, but we arranged a process which took some skill to, within about 2 or 3 hours, we organized about 120 people to self-organize into groups that were important for them, and they didn't know they'd be doing that at the beginning of the 2 hours. And it actually worked quite well, and one of the groups was gay men. And that group stayed together for the 5 or 6 days. I think we had morning and afternoon sessions. And out of that, there was a desire to meet more regularly. That's my understanding of the history. So I always feel a connection when I come here, because I was one of the lead organizers for that whole summer institute. And I have worked with Buddhist Peace Fellowship for about 20 years, a little less closely the last few years, but the work there has been with a program called the BASE program, which some of you know. Paul is a longtime friend and graduate of that program. The BASE program stands for Buddhist Alliance for Social Engagement, and named to have resonance with the BASE community movement in Latin America. The idea of small groups that would be meeting regularly and would connect people's inner work with their work in the world, particularly service and social change. And sort of a descendant of that is this Path of Engagement program. It has about 50 people in it. Baruch Golden is a member of the program, who is active here. And actually, he's on a one-month retreat now, as many of you know. And I saw him Friday. He's doing well. He will have stories to tell when he comes back. So, but that Path of Engagement is a two-year program, and people from actually Canada and other parts of the U.S. as well. And we come together for 5 7-day retreats over 2 years. And otherwise, we have a structure that involves monthly groups, either in person or on the phone, and mentoring, more or less monthly meeting with a mentor. And we have study and practice material each month, which kind of sets out a curriculum. And we're completing the first two-year cycle in May, and probably we'll do another cycle starting in about a year and a half or so. I'm going to take a break. I've been the director of that program, and it's more work than I thought. So pleased to be here, and I just say that I brought a few little materials. I brought a copy of my teaching schedule, and the next thing I'm doing, actually, for anyone who has the next 2 days free, I'm co-teaching with Sylvia Borstein a two-day non-residential retreat at Spirit Rock, 9 to 5 both days, Monday and Tuesday. It's kind of an experiment. And so you can just show up for both or one day. And I have my other things in my schedule here. And I also brought in some copies of a reading list on Buddhist practice and meditation, including reading on engaged Buddhism and also on connection between Buddhist practice and psychology and psychotherapy, which has also been an interest of mine. So, and then I did bring a few copies of a book which sort of crystallized about 15 years of this work connecting inner and outer work, and I brought a few copies here. It's called The Engaged Spiritual Life, subtitled A Buddhist Approach to Transforming Ourselves and the World. And I think of it really as a practice manual. There's a background that has a wide understanding, but it has a lot of exercises really designed for people to bring into practice this connection of inner and outer. So I'll talk for a little bit and try to be attentive to the time and leave some time open for us to talk together, which is usually my favorite part of being here, is the dialogue and the interaction. So I'll try to be brief, although the topic I chose to talk about is compassion. And in part I chose this because I myself was on retreat for the whole month of February. And the practice that I chose to do almost all of that time was the practice of the Brahma-Vihara, or the Divine Abodes, which is the practice of loving-kindness, compassion, joy, particularly joy in the joy of others, and equanimity. Many of you, I'm sure, are quite familiar with these four practices, and I did them the whole month. And I also, in particular, mostly did the last three. So I more or less did about a week of each of them. And using phrases, which is one way of doing these practices. Most of you probably know loving kindness practice and the phrases and that way of practicing. You know, may I be happy and contented? May I be as healthy or as healthy as possible? May I be safe and so forth? May I live with ease? And we had the same practices for the other three. And that's the practice I was doing. And I was really inspired by that to sort of go more fully into all of these. So I wanted to talk a little bit about compassion today. It's a very familiar topic, probably for many of us. It's really right at the heart of what we do. And it's not so much that we demand ourselves to be compassionate, but we take this as one of our core intentions. You know, we find ourselves sometimes compassionate, sometimes not so compassionate, self-centered or distracted or whatever. But we keep on trying to come back, just like we come back to the open heart and to wisdom. And many of you know that one of the main ways that Buddhism is talked about, it's said that the Buddha Dharma, or the teachings of liberation, are like a bird that has two wings, and the two wings are wisdom and compassion. So it's taken that compassion is right there, and also, I'll talk more about this later, that it has a very important relationship with wisdom. It's not, and I love also in the 20th century in Vietnam, they had inherited this model of wisdom and compassion. And in the context of crisis, they said, actually, we need a three-winged bird. So I don't know if they were imagining mysterious, mythical three-winged birds, but they said wisdom and compassion needs to be complemented by courage. And I love that. That's really stayed with me so much. I learned this from a good friend, Thich Minh Duc, who's a Vietnamese monk, and I worked with him over a lot of years. He actually did a dissertation on the history of engaged Buddhism in Vietnam. Very beautiful piece of work. And he said that courage was taken to be equal, these three. And it's almost as if, you know, in the way I hear this, it's like wisdom is the aspect of understanding, we might say the aspect of the mind. Compassion is the aspect of the heart. And courage, we might say, is the aspect of the body. You know, so we have that, need that integration. And we'll come back to that. Compassion in the Pali language is karuna. Literally means the quivering of the heart when there is suffering present. So it's taken that compassion is a natural quality. Essentially, when we're not scared or distracted or startled and there is suffering in our presence, we are compassionate. Of course, the problem is what? That we're startled, distracted, and scared and self-centered a good deal of the time. That's why we practice. But I love that it's really actually we don't produce compassion. It's more like we keep on examining our minds, our hearts, our bodies so that compassion can emerge quite naturally. And it emerges in many ways. We can see it emerge in our formal meditation practice. Simply when we're with, for example, our own suffering sitting, there tends to be compassion emerging. I sit with something that is painful for me, or I sit with a painful situation in the world, and when I, again, am not knocked around by it, but I just come back to that quality of just being present, there can be the compassion which arises. It's really this quality which knows that it's not easy to be a human being, essentially. There's a story that I love, which I heard from Houston Smith, who's been one of my mentors. Some of you know he's a great teacher of the mystical traditions of the world and of religion in general. And he told me he had been with Aldous Huxley, the writer, at the end of Huxley's life. And Huxley was telling him, you know, people ask me all of these difficult questions. They expect me to be able to give answers to the most profound questions of life and metaphysical questions and so forth. And what I tell them is, what I've learned over all these years, he was saying this right before he died, is just be a little kinder. Just be a little kinder. Because it's hard. You know, we have beautiful, glorious moments. But it's this form of reality definitely has its challenging moments, definitely has its challenging aspects. I'm reminded of this story that's attributed to Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher. He was, he said he had something very important to tell to people, and he said, the problems that you now have in your life, and then he had a long pause, and everyone was waiting for him to say, okay, with Zen practice, you can totally get rid of the problems you have in your life and transform these problems you have in your life. So he said, the problems that you now have in your life, pause, will be with you for the rest of your life. And it really, I think it points to that need of compassion. So we practice doing our daily practice, our sitting. We can also do the compassion practice that I was practicing for that 1 week, they call it the Brahma Vihara Divine Abode practice, of using phrases. We can just repeat them, much like we do metta. We can use the phrase, one that I use, for example, very simple. May I be free of suffering, may I be free of the roots of suffering. And it's important in talking about suffering and talking about compassion, I think, to be a little more precise about what we mean by suffering, because I think it's really a key aspect of the teachings. And I think it's often quite misunderstood, but I think that the Buddha made a very clear distinction between pain and suffering, between something like pain and suffering. And pain is not the problem, but rather suffering is more the reaction to pain. It's the way that we can't be with something difficult without what? Blaming ourselves, blaming others, reacting in body and mind. And the Buddha used this very powerful analogy, which I love. It's one of perhaps my, one of my favorite, definitely, I was going to say my favorite, but I was going to say one of my favorite, for sure. I won't complete the competition this morning. But one of my favorite teachings is that it's called the teachings of the two arrows, or sometimes called the two darts. And how many of you know this teaching? It's a powerful one. It says that we all are as if shot by an arrow or a dart. And that is the arrow of suffering. I'm sorry, the arrow of pain. It's the fact that we have physical pain, we have emotional pain, we're treated unfairly at times, we get ill, we die. There's pain, there's painful experiences in our lives. He said those are there for both the practitioner and the non-practitioner. So what distinguishes the practitioner from the non-practitioner? He said the non-practitioner tends, because of the first arrow, because of the pain, to shoot a second arrow at both oneself, we might say, and others. So I get, someone speaks harshly or meanly to me, and depending on my psychological tendencies, I will either say something mean and harsh back to that person, or I might blame myself, you know. But each of those examples, that's the second arrow. And so much of conflict is what is two sides shooting the second arrow at each other. Middle East, it has a lot of complexity, but on one level, it's a lot of second arrows continually being shot, and each side using the last second arrow shot by the other as the reason for each of them to shoot a second arrow. It's also something that we do when our body feels something unpleasant. We often tense. We get tight. And something that I've heard from doctors is 80% of what's experienced as physical pain is not the stimulus itself to start with, but it's the reaction. That's why meditation is so powerful when it's brought to the medical field. Because so much of what is actually experienced as pain, we might say, is the second arrow happening. The second arrow is also what happens with, you know, when there's some kind of unfairness or oppression, and we just react back, whether it's interpersonal or social, we just react back. And so the Buddha says that the practitioner learns to be with pain, and I think ultimately respond out of compassion rather than out of reactivity and suffering. It's a tall order. Right? It's a tall order. It's really, I think it's a, this is for me one of the clearest ways to talk about the whole teaching. Really, because it's, can I respond out of compassion and wisdom even when I have pain? Even when I have pain delivered at me? You know, can I do that? And I would interpret the work of Gandhi and King as precisely the same teaching. We have received oppression. We will not pass it on. We will not keep the cycles of oppression or pain going. And so it's a very deep teaching, but this means that we can learn to be with pain, and we can be with our own suffering and others. And when we can be with it, what tends to come out is more compassion. So we can practice compassion on the cushion, being with pain, being with our own suffering. We can do the Brahmavihara practices of using phrases, which are really the systematic practice for cultivating compassion. We can do practices like Tonglen, which some of you probably know from the Tibetan tradition. Beautiful practice of breathing in pain of others, of oneself, of a particular person, and breathing out peace. Pema Chodron is one of the great teachers of Tonglen in this country. We can do those kind of practices. We can also, in a way, bring our compassion practice out into the world, out into our daily lives. There's a beautiful, very short instruction on compassion from Thich Nhat Hanh. It goes like this. Do not avoid contact with suffering, or close your eyes before suffering. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering by all means, including personal contacts and visits, images, sound. By such means, awaken yourself and others to the reality of suffering in the world. And so this is something that I'm sure is familiar for many or all of us, this intention to be compassionate, that we, in a sense, we do that practice when we're with someone who is sick, we're with someone who is ill, with someone who is distressed. And we can really take that as just as much a practice as being on the cushion. Or we find ways, if in our community, our families, our organizations, there's suffering. How do we, in a way, also do compassion practice in that case? A lot of it is often just to let the compassion speak. It's very hard to do because so much of times when there's pain or suffering, it kind of gets hidden. It has a hard time finding the surface. And organizations, very few organizations, I think, are skillful about suffering in their organization. You know, it's like, how many meetings have you been to where the elephant of suffering is in the middle of the room and people are trying to make believe it's not there? And that's, of course, the case socially as well. You know, and we have the very, you know, intensified suffering now with this economic collapse, right? So what would compassionate practice mean? You know, I was inspired by reading of from Michael Lerner, from the, some of you know, who's the editor of Tikkun and has a, who's a rabbi and a social activist. And he talked about how it was really important in this time to actively attend to those in the community who may have lost jobs or may be underemployed. And so he did something very beautiful. He assembled the names of people in his community. He asked them, write to me and tell me what you do if you feel underemployed, if you need more work. And he sent out an email with these people's names and their capabilities. You know, very simple actions like that. That's, for me, compassion practice. You know, so some of it's really the more receptive aspect of compassion is to listen, to be empathic, to be there, to let someone feel heard, listen to, and so forth. But there's also this active dimension of compassion. So it's, for me, helpful to think of these two main aspects, the receptive and the active dimensions of compassion. Some of you know the images of Avalokitesvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, you know, who in, I really like this, in India is male, and then in Tibet starts to undergo transgender changes, you know, and becomes both male and female in Tibet. And by the time Avalokitesvara gets to China, entirely female. You know, so it'd be quite interesting. But in all of the cultures embodies compassion, and in many of the images of Avalokitesvara, some of you know, sometimes has 1,000 arms, and on each of those arms is a hand with an eye. And the eye, for me, symbolizes, I think for many, it symbolizes the receptive aspect of compassion, the ability to see, to notice, to listen. And then there's the act, the arms and the hands are the active dimension of compassion. Maybe just a few further words, and then I'll open it up. Something that was really important for me doing the 4 weeks of the practices of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity was seeing how they interrelate and how they require each other. It's a really important aspect in relation to compassion. So one of the ways we talk about these four is we say that loving kindness is the natural expression of the open heart. When that open heart encounters pain or suffering, it becomes compassion. When it's present with beauty and joy, one's own joy or another's happiness, it becomes mudita, joy and the joy of others. And when it is generally there and balancing the other three, it's equanimity. And there's a beautiful way in which all four get integrated. That's what I was experiencing a lot during the retreat, how all four were there. I'd be wishing, you know, wishing to another person, may you transform your suffering. May you transform the roots of your suffering. And there would be compassion. But then I would also maybe have a sense, well, these problems are deep. And I'd have more of the wisdom dimension, which would tell me about causes and conditions, and have a sense that this is my wish, but the reality is here are the causes of the suffering, and it may take time to transform them. And so there's this way in which compassion has to get somehow unified with wisdom, unified with equanimity. Equanimity is what can have the patience, the long view. Because many of us probably work in the helping professions, and we know that compassion can be beautiful, but it's very easy to lead to burnout. And so the question is, how do we avoid burnout? One of the best responses is this teaching of the four abodes and the balancing factor. So we balance compassion with wisdom or equanimity. We also balance it with joy, you know, which I know many people in service professions, they're guilty. I don't personally have this issue so much, but I know others do. They're guilty about doing things that they enjoy because there's so much work to be done. Does anyone relate to that? Maybe, well, not so much. But I've been in some places where most of the hands go up at times. Like I've had sometimes worked with people in the service professions. A lot of hands go up, particularly people who are raised in guilt culture. And so Thich Nhat Hanh says it like this. He says, from Being Peace, he has a chapter called Suffering is Not Enough. Life is filled with suffering, but it is also filled with many wonders, like the blue sky, the sunshine, the eyes of a baby. To suffer is not enough. We must also be in touch with the wonders of life. They are within us and all around us, everywhere, anytime. So I love this sense of having these four qualities, because it means if you're moving into being with suffering a lot and you're feeling imbalanced or burned out in some way, you can use this teaching. And it says, okay, time to really do that which brings about joy and come back to balance, whether it's for a day, a week, a year. Focus more there. Or let me understand more the bigger picture, the patience. Let me develop equanimity. So let me close just with, I think, two passages about this balance from a wonderful essay that's available on the web by Nayana Ponikatera. Has a beautiful essay on the four qualities of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity called The Four Sublime States, which you can find at the Access to Insight website. These days, it's not uncommon for Dharma talks to include internet references. I don't know what was the equivalent for the Buddha. But anyway, this is what he says about that balance. And particularly, I'll give two passages about one about compassion and equanimity, and the other one about compassion and joy. Joy holds compassion back from becoming overwhelmed by the sights of the world's suffering, from being absorbed by it to the exclusion of everything else. Mudita, or sympathetic joy, relieves the tension of mind, soothes the painful burning of the compassionate heart. It keeps compassion away from melancholic brooding without purpose, from a futile sentimentality that merely weakens and consumes the strength of mind and heart. That joy develops compassion into active sympathy. And then about the relation between equanimity and compassion. Compassion guards equanimity from falling into cold indifference. And then he says, let me see, where is it? Compassion guards equanimity from falling into cold indifference. It furnishes equanimity, on the other hand, furnishes compassion with an even, unwavering courage and fearlessness, enabling it to face the awesome abyss of misery and despair which confront boundless compassion again and again. To the active side of compassion, equanimity is the calm and firm hand led by wisdom, indispensable to those who want to practice the difficult art of helping others. And here again, equanimity means patience, the patient devotion to the work of compassion. That means that the talk is over. Okay. So we have, looks like about 12, 13 minutes for some talk among us. That was very good, whoever did that. So any questions either about the talk or about some of the programs I talked about or any really anything? Please, Paul.
I was glad you talked about compassion as a practice because most of the time I hear about metta as a practice. And I signed up for James Barris's course on joy.
Yeah.
Which I signed up for a second year because I really wasn't paying attention to it. But it's just a real opening for me, you know, because, you know, they are a great package deal.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you explained the interrelations, the
interrelationship
of the four.
Yeah. It's a, it, yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
It's a very beautiful and subtle teaching. When you think about it, it really is about the interrelationship, how each of these, I believe, to be mature, needs the other three. So joy, to be mature, needs to be linked with compassion and wisdom via equanimity. I love that. It's really, it's very, it's so helpful. It's very, very, it's wise. Please.
Sometimes a compassion practice, like when I attempt it in my day-to-day life, just dealing with difficult people, mostly is where it comes up. There's this assumption that I have that, okay, if I behave compassionately, this person is probably going to respond to me differently.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's not true.
Yeah.
And so when I'm challenged in that way, it's like I realize how conditional my compassion is.
Yeah.
Now, was there a point in your practice where you kind of really saw that clearly and saw a shift in that conditionality? Do you see what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Everyone hear the question? Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it really links, maybe say two things. One is it really links up with a general aspect of our whole practice, which is that we want to look for those ways in which we basically have a bargain or have a deal that we're making with our own minds. You know, that, okay, if I do this, I should be this way. You know, or if I'm compassionate with this difficult person, the other person will change. And yeah, it's a huge part of practice. It's also a huge aspect of social service or social change work. As a teacher, it's a big issue, you know. Am I invested in the people I work with necessarily changing? What happens if they don't? Do I get angry at them? Do I start being judgmental? And so it's a really, I think it's actually quite a difficult issue in general. So I love that you mentioned it, because it really is something really to look for. The actual, say two more things, one in general and one about my own experience, is in this book, I actually love that issue so much that it's actually the last chapter of the book is entirely about that issue. And I talked about it in terms of a balance between deep committed action and non-attachment to outcome. Not easy. Easy to talk about. Not so easy in experience. And it means just having, a lot of it comes down to really, I think for me, sometimes it's come down to really being, that's where this is all intention practice. It's like, I am inclining in this direction. And what happens when others don't seem to respond? Does that mean that I don't have a commitment to compassion? That comes up like that, you know, can challenge it. Is my compassion only supposed to be valuable when it works in the way that I think it should work? And so I think it's come to me to be deep in my sense of, this is what I do no matter what happens. You know, I commit to compassion because it's the law of my nature, or it's the deepest understanding I have. And so it's challenging. And it also, this is where the wisdom dimension comes in. The compassion aspect responds compassionately, and the wisdom aspect can see the causes and conditions, maybe with the other person. You know, and that's where it can actually, and it's very hard to do. How can I, when I'm emotionally invested, actually look clearly and see where this other person's coming from? Not easy. And so, I remember incidents where I found myself with so-called difficult people, just starting to go through the same little dance that I've done before. And I remember this one very clear experience where someone who I worked with, where at a certain point I just said, I'm starting that same dance one more time, done it quite a number of times. And something just said, I'm doing it again. And I just started seeing more clearly all the factors in myself, which tended to make me do it, and all the factors in the other person. And I just had this wide view of these colliding sets of causal factors. And that was very helpful because I started, and it's still an ongoing practice, how can I look and see someone accurately without my projections? Huge, obviously. Please, Clark.
Yeah. I remember you gave a talk at the DPP once and you alluded to this time period where, and I can't remember how long it was, that you realized that the best thing to do for you was to decorate your home as opposed to doing something
That's right.
of service. And I was just wondering, I was so intrigued by that. What was that like, and what sort of caused that?
Well, Clark is referring to a true event in my life in which it was actually a time when I was supposed to be finishing this book. I had a deadline in a few months. And I had felt a deep urge. I was scheduled to do a month retreat in February. I think the book manuscript was like due in June or something, the full manuscript. And I did 5 weeks of loving kindness practice. And it was beautiful. And loving kindness is a lot about connecting with the beautiful. And with and following that, I should have just gone back with deep energy, commitment, and finished my book. And all I wanted to do was try to create my own environment at home to be more maybe reflective of the quality of loving kindness and more beautiful. And so instead of finishing my book, I spent just hours and hours doing interior decoration. And it was very interesting to reflect on that phrase, interior decoration. I realized this was happening, and I asked my editor whether I could have a different close date for the manuscript. And luckily, they were flexible. I don't know what would have happened otherwise. But that's what I did. I actually took 2 or 3 months, and this was my main work. It was almost like I couldn't do otherwise. It was kind of, I think it came out of those 5 weeks, so it's quite interesting. So really honoring those impulses or deep directions that come out of somewhere deep in us. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about compassion and sort of seeing the suffering of others outside of ourselves.
Yeah.
Is the practice of compassion towards oneself the same as the practice towards others outside of oneself?
Yeah, in terms of the formal practices, is that what you're asking
about,
Parley? Yeah, yes, it is. I was saying that I think there are two main aspects of the formal practice. One is simply being present with one's experience, and in one's experience, we can be with one's suffering, emotional suffering, physical suffering, and so forth. And compassion naturally arises from that mindfulness practice. And the formal practice of compassion, it's like the loving kindness practice. We go through different categories, including ourselves. So the usual order of doing compassion and practice, and we typically use the same phrases. So my phrases were, may I be free of suffering, may I be free of the roots of suffering. And there are other phrases like that one can use, I care about your suffering, or I care about my suffering, or may my suffering end, or may I feel peace, or something like this. You can really make the phrases your own. But in that sequence, we typically start with someone who we know quite well, who's suffering a lot. And then we would typically go through the same sequence as in loving kindness. So we would go then to ourselves, to a benefactor or teacher, then to a dear friend, then to a neutral person, then to a difficult person, and then to all beings. So it's done in the same way. Yeah. So I think we have time for maybe one more. Is there
We have time, Joe?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Well, of course, thank you for being here, Donald. And we'll keep you in the loop.
Yeah.
Twice a year, maybe 4 times a year. and this may be like over the top, but it's been on my heart this week, of course, with the tragedies in Oakland.
Yeah.
And in the spirit of the three wings of wisdom and compassion and courage, clearly hypothetical, but if you were invited to speak at that funeral, representing the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, what would be a Buddhist word that might be spoken in that setting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a challenge, and it'd probably be easier to speak in another context than the funeral, to be honest, because I think in that setting there are certain things that can be heard and certain things that can't be heard. So I think it's a hard situation. I heard that they I was actually away some of that weekend or I was away that day, But I heard that they didn't allow, some of the families didn't want Ron Dellums to speak. You see, so it's not that context. I don't think there's a great deal of openness. So, but I'll tell you what I would want to say were there some openness. And if I was invited to speak in a context in which there's not so much openness, then the message would change, right? So I want to just acknowledge that. But what I would most want to say, if there was some degree of openness, is I think something about how it really relates to reflecting a lot about conflict, which both Paul and Clark were at a two-day training that I gave with Lawrence Ellis. You know, some of you may know Lawrence. He's been very active on Prop 8, actually. And we gave this training together on conflict, and a lot of what I would say would be to offer some of what some of the tools for dealing with entrenched conflict. So there's partly, because I think I would partly see, there are just so many levels of this, because there's of course the level of the loss and of the sadness and of the deaths of the four officers, and I guess the injuring of one, right? So that's very, very real. And I think I would talk about compassion. I would talk about the tendency when there's pain to shoot the second arrow. And I would say, can you just stay with that pain and have some discipline and watch where your mind goes? You know, I read the Chronicle and the letters to the editor, and people's minds are going in all directions, right? You know, this, you know, as taking this event to lead to, you know, and they're going in opposite directions too from the event. So to really see if one can just be with that and stay at the level of compassion and watch the tendency of mind when there's pain to shoot the second arrows, to go way off in terms of assumptions, thoughts, and so forth. It's almost like everyone's, you know, pre-existing views are brought into bear as if these events confirm them. It's interesting. So that's one point, to watch that. And then to, you know, I think I would also somehow try to urge people to be peacemakers. And a peacemaker tries to be compassionate towards all involved. You know, and it's very clear, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, it's a lot of things we don't know, and it's hard to generalize, but I would want to go to see this as also reflecting the tragedy of this person who shot the officers, you know, and that there, you know, and just the complex issues that are there in terms of entrenched poverty and the aspects of the prison system and so forth. And try to have the discipline somehow to be able to be compassionate towards all involved and be very careful of polarization. You know, and I think there's polarization, there tends to be polarization as a whole on all sides. You know, and to be really careful about that and learn how to be attentive to the pain and suffering of all involved. That would be a brief starting point, but I'm I've really learned so much from teaching a lot about conflict the last 9 months or so. You know, and quite a few, you know, in these trainings and workshops, and also about a month ago, a little less than a month ago, I was invited to help participate in work done by some organizations right at the UN on bringing spiritual resources to bear with international conflicts. It was quite powerful. We were a group of people who helped with particularly conflicts involving religion. You know, and we worked with a situation in Sri Lanka, which is quite volatile. And I think there are tools, and the real aim is to keep the compassion and then bring in the wisdom which sees the causes and conditions and the joy which lets one keep balance. Short answer. Thank you
very much. Do we have announcements today?
Yeah, I'm Paul and I'm your host. And first of all, I want to announce that
yesterday of what? Two front row center O's tickets to Wicked for Wednesday night, and I got them at $40 each. So if anyone wants to go see Wicked on Wednesday night, I have a ticket. And I also have a ticket someone just canceled out on me for a play at Oakland called Old Times on Thursday night by Theater First, which is an excellent company that you should employ professional actors. This one has Peter Callender in it, who's the lead actor in the Bay Area. And that's only $11 because I always look for specials on that. In terms of hosting, there are refreshments out there and celebration of Donald Rockberg. I have some bagels and cream cheese. I have a platter of fruit, you know, for your enjoyment. And you're asked to have tea. You're invited to have tea, and you're invited to clean your cup and put it back afterwards. There's a sign-up sheet out there. If you aren't getting the newsletter, there's a sheet dedicated to you're getting the newsletter either electronically or a hard copy. And I'll be going around with the Donna Bowl. And we figured out once that it costs between, you know, it costs around $8 a person per meeting to sustain our work. Not only to pay the bills, but to sustain some of the social engagement work we do. And what else is there? Another host here to remember what? They must remember anything I forgot here.
People might meet for lunch.
Sorry?
People might meet for lunch.
Yeah. People after the social hour might meet for lunch. And someone will do the news.
Well, if I make an announcement and it's the last Sunday of the odd-numbered month, then it's newsletter. We have newsletters available online at gaybuddhist.org, but we send out about over 300 hard copies, about two-thirds of which go to prisoners. And so after we've done the tea and refreshments, then if about 8 or 10 of us can get together to fold, staple, label, stamp, then that will be real helpful. Would people put up their hands so I can make sure that there's at least that number who can do that? That's good. Thank you.
Yeah, just one thing I forgot to say. If anyone wants to stay in touch, I have a little sign-up sheet to get emails, which I send about 3 or 4 times a year. You can sign up here, and then there's also the teaching schedule, the reading list, and also a few copies of the book.
I just wanted to know for the day long, I don't know who's in charge of this, but there was mention that you need to register, and I don't know exactly how you go about registering. I didn't see it online.
Sorry. There's a sheet out there.
There's a sheet out there. Is there? Okay, great. Thank you.
Next week, just as kind of an experiment at the beginning of the sitting, we're going to do maybe 5 minutes of instruction. There's been a little bit of interest shown in people that wanted a little bit of instruction. It's a way to do it and see if you like it or not. So if you don't, go and go.
So our speaker next week will be Alan Sanaki.
Oh.
Vice Abbot at the Berkeley Zen Center. We look forward to his presence with us next week.
And Alan is a long time, was for many years the director of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and he and I have worked together for 20 years. He can continue some of these themes. That's great. Say hi to him.
And I just wanted to put in a plug for Donald's work, because I'm fresh from a 2-day retreat 2 weekends ago to Clark that I attended. On conflict, and there was a lot of balance between teaching and meditation and meditative walking, and I'm involved somewhat in the helping profession. It was really good to get handouts that I could keep for my own reference and for the reference of some people who need help. I like to contact them.
closing?
Sure. Yeah. Is that everything? Reflecting that we come together to support our practices of opening and wisdom and compassion and courage. And that we do this not just for ourselves, but also for others. And we, in recognizing this, offer what's been valuable and beautiful, helpful, whatever that is from the morning, from our practice, from our time together, we offer that out beyond the boundaries of this building, out into the world for the benefit and healing and freedom and transformation of all beings. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.